We're going to look at some of the Agadot related to Ma'amad Har Sinai. And in order to properly introduce it, that really about half the shiur is going to be a little bit of an introduction and overview to Midrash Agadah, both the background, the style, the dating a little bit, collections, and most specifically how Midrash Agadah fits into Talmud Bavli, because we're looking at passages from the Gemara. There you go. So, what is Midrash? We say the word Midrash, because we're looking at Midrashim today. What is a Midrash?
An attempt to provide an explanation for a text that may or may not be unclear.
Okay.
Would it also include commentaries?
Sort of. So, a Midrash, by literally the word lidrosh means to seek. You're seeking something. And what are you seeking? In Midrash, capital M, you're seeking more information from the verse that's readily there. So the verse says, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim et haaretz. What's readily there is, in the beginning God had created the heavens and the earth. And then you look through all sorts of devices and identify other lessons that may be buried in the text, and now I'm going to go out on a second limb, or that you may want to bury in the text, right? And the difference between what we call exegesis and eisegesis, meaning, are you drawing out from the text, or are you putting into the text? And the reality is we do both. Meaning, sometimes we'll read a pasuk, and we'll see that the pasuk is worded in an odd way, uses excessive language, something of a nuance that's beckoning for interpretation, and we'll say there's something else going on here than what meets the eye, and we'll draw something out. Okay? On the other hand, sometimes the text will say what it says, or we've drawn out what we can draw out, and we want to attach another lesson to it, and so we'll throw it in. I'll give an example in a second right now. I'll give an example of both. In Bereshit, we all know the pasuk in Kiddush from Vayichulu. Vayivarech Elohim et Yom Hashvi'i Vayikadesh Oto. God blessed the seventh day and He sanctified it. So, what does that mean? So, if we're standing at Har Sinai when this happens, then we understand what it means. God said, "Don't do work on this day." God said, "I'm going to give you extra man that will last 2 days." We understand that. However, this is being said at creation. So the Midrash says, "Bamer bercho, v'amer kidsho," and that's now commentary, like interpreting what does it mean that God blessed it and God sanctified it. And so one of the examples is bercho b'man v'kidsho b'man. He sanctified it with the man and he blessed it with the man. Meaning he sanctified it because no man fell on Shabbat, and he blessed it that the man lasted as fresh for 2 days. All right, good. So and there was double on Friday. So that's piece number one. Then piece number two, Rabbi Shlomo Nachmani comes along, quoting his Rebbe, Rebbe Yonatan, and says that what's the bracha of Shabbat, is that all of the other holidays could be on any day of the week. On any day of the week. Shabbat never moves. So God sanctified Shabbat, as if to say, it stays here forever. Now, is that what's being intended by the pasuk? Likely not. So where is Rav Shlomo Bar Nachmani coming from? So almost assuredly, I can't put nails on this one, but almost assuredly, he's responding to Paul, who took Shabbat and switched it to Sunday. And Rav Shlomo Bar Nachmani, coming along 100+ years afterwards, in a world in which already in the Galil, there are Christians who are now starting to observe Sunday Shabbat, the counterclaim is, no, you see back in Bereshit, that God already sanctified that day, that it should never move. Now, that's what we would like call eisegesis, no pun intended, but that means that we have an idea, and then we are reading it into the text, so that the text now becomes an anchor for an idea that was never intended by the text. Right? And those are the sort of the two modes. Now, Midrash itself operates here, regular Gemara, Steinsaltz, English, all of them?
English.
Okay? And so the Midrash itself operates on two planes. There is Midrash Halacha and Midrash Agadah. Midrash Halacha is exactly what it sounds like. When we take verses that are in legal texts, and we extrapolate from them using various different tools, extra halachic instruction. Midrash halacha is very tight. The rules are tight. The rules for hermeneutic reading, for drawing things out of the text, are tight. And we have different schools that have different rules. So the school of Rabbi Yishmael looked at statements as klal uprat, and the school of Rabbi Akiva looked at them as ribu yomiut. And there's all sorts of other variations in those nuances. And the goal was to draw more halacha out of halachic texts. Another important nuance to it is that in a discussion of Midrash Halacha, if you're right, then I'm wrong. So I'm going to have to prove you wrong to make me right. In other words, in a discussion in Midrash Halacha, you'll find you're making a certain claim based on this, and I'll say, no, that claim is wrong because of this, and my claim, I'm going to promote my claim. Because at the end of the process, there has to be an agreed upon halacha, and I need to persuade you in a compelling way that my position is the right one. Now, that's Midrash Halacha. So Midrash Halacha, by the way, Midrash Halacha was taught in the Beit Midrash. The Midrashei Halacha that we have are universally in Hebrew, and the Midrashei Halacha that we have were compiled evidently in Rav's Beit Midrash, but they were all the names in the Midrash Halacha are names that you know from the Mishnah. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Eliezer, etc. That's Midrash Halacha. And there's Midrash Halacha. The main book of Midrash Halacha is a commentary in Vayikra, and it's called The Book, which is Sifra. And the other ones, which is there's a smaller collection on Bamidbar Dvarim, which is called Sifrei, which means the other books. And there's another book on part of Shemot, which is called Mechilta, because part of Shemot is Halacha. There's no Midrash Halacha in Bereishit, and there's no Midrash Halacha, let's say, on the first 11 chapters of Shemot, and other sections of Shemot. So in other words, it only operates within that realm. However, when we say Midrash, almost always, we're referring to Midrash Agadah. And Midrash Agadah is everything else. All the other Midrashim that we have that are either on non-legal texts like narrative, prophecy, poetry, etc., or even if they're on legal texts, to draw out non-legal lessons and non-legal information, meaning things that aren't about law, but are about ethics, are about history, are about background, are about language, whatever it might be, as long as it's not about halacha, it's Midrash Agadah. So Agadah is sort of the default. Everything that's not halacha is Agadah. Midrash Agadah means there's a pasuk associated with it. Midrashei Agadah overwhelmingly were taught in Aramaic. And Midrashei Agadah were overwhelmingly not presented in the Beit Midrash, but rather in the Beit Knesset. Because the audience of the Midrashei Agadah was the people. And the Midrashei Agadah that we have, broadly, are on 10 books of Tanakh. And that is, why 10 books? Which 10 books would it be? Because the Midrashei Agadah that we have were taught in the Beit Knesset. So which 10 books would it be?
Matthew, Luke.
Right? That's four. You're not going to get a fifth. No, Midrash Haggadah. Midrash Haggadah. So you have five Chumashim and five Megillot. Five Megillot. Why five Chumashim and five Megillot? Because those are read publicly. And since they're read publicly, so before the reading, the Baal Drasha would get up and give some sort of a homily with a lesson that is based on something they're about to read. So around Purim time, you would have somebody get up and talk about one of the psukim in Megillat Esther, or a whole parsha of Megillat Esther, and all weave in the Midrashim. Right? Now, Midrashim, we have collections of Midrashim. The Midrashim, by the way, are Midrashei Agadah are later. The compilation, the earliest compilation we have is about 4th century, but it goes all the way to the 9th century, 10th century. And it depends on which book. So we have, which would you like, Steinsaltz or regular Gemara or English or all three of them? Or you have choices.
What?
You have choices. Regular Gemara, Steinsaltz, English?
English.
English. Okay. So the Midrashim are collected, and these collections, the most popular and largest and most common collection that we have, commonly known collection, is called Midrash Rabbah. Midrash Rabbah is not one book. It's 10 different books, and they're from different periods, all from Eretz Yisrael, but from somewhere between the 4th and 9th century. Bereshit Rabbah, for instance, and Eicha Rabbah, we typically date around 4th century. Bamidbar Rabbah is like about 8th century. Dvarim Rabbah might be 9th century. Different times during that period. Now, many of these Midrashim are much earlier Midrashim that were transmitted Baal Peh and were very popular and got repeated until finally when the collections were made, they were put together and made it into the anthology. And of course, all of Midrash, both Midrash Halacha, Midrash Haggadah, is not thematically sequenced, but textually sequenced. So that unlike Gemara, where you have to look for a topic, in Midrash, you look for the Pasuk. So if you want to see all sorts of different homilies on Cain and Hevel, you'll go to near the beginning of Bereshit Rabbah, into you get to the section where Cain is born and Hevel is born, and et cetera, and then you'll find all the Midrashim there. And if you want to find Yosef and Mrs. Potiphar, you'll go closer to the end of Bereshit Rabbah, and you'll find that story in Vayeshev, in the Midrash on Vayeshev. Now, the interesting thing is that Midrashim also make their way into the Gemara, both in the Yerushalmi and the Bavli. And we're looking at a piece of the Bavli here, and one of the interesting pieces about Midrashim is how Midrashim get put into where they get put into in Gemara. In other words, there's no Gemara called Masechet Midrash. There's no Masechet that's devoted to homiletics, right? But there are collections. So, for instance, in the ninth parak of Brachot, there are about 3 pages in a row, and you know how big a page of Gemara is, and a page of Gemara at the end of Brachot means a little bit of Rashi and that's it. Huge page. 3 pages in a row or so, maybe a little bit more, all about dreams. You see this in a dream, see that in a dream, see this in a dream, and this is what a dream interpreter does, and there's a story about a dream interpreter, and all sorts of things about dreams. Right? Some people like to refer to it as the Talmudic Book of Dreams. Right? There's that passage. There is a very, very long section, a well-known section, we've studied parts of it together, which is the second half of the first parak of Masechet Megillah, goes through the entire Megillat Esther from the beginning to the end, with the Midrashim. It presents the Midrashim, it's known as the Babylonian Esther Midrash. Right? But it goes through the Midrashim. Those Midrashim, as we saw a couple years ago, are different in a lot of ways than the Midrash Esther Rabbah, which is from Eretz Israel. So we have Babylonian Midrashim here, and often the Babylonian Midrashim, oddly enough, are in Hebrew. I'm not saying oddly because the language, everybody spoke Aramaic, but I'm saying because they seem to be a little bit more scholastic, if you will. All right, because as you'll see, and you'll see in most of the Agadot that we look at here, we're going to see are in Hebrew. Now, the last thing I want to do before plunging into and to see a couple of the Agadot here is how do Agadot get placed where they get placed? So the second half of the first parak of Megillah being the Midrash on Esther Rabbah is kind of a no-brainer. It's Masechet Megillah. Where else are you going to put it? However, many other Agadot, Agadic collections, like at the end of Shabbat, the whole collection of, if you're born on this day of the week, you're going to have this kind of tendency, and then Ein Mazal Yisrael, Yesh Mazal Yisrael, that whole discussion, where it starts from, so it almost always starts just the way Gemara starts. How, we've all studied Gemara, how does a discussion in Gemara get started? Like, how can we have a discussion in the Gemara? Brachot about, well, let's take it in halacha context. How come you have a sugyan Masechet Brachot about Tefillat HaDerech? Halachic discussion about Tefillat HaDerech. When you say Tefillat HaDerech, do you have to stand still? Can you be walking when you say Tefillat HaDerech? Right? Why is that discussion in there at all? Because the Gemara was not a composed book. Nobody sat down and said, okay, we just wrote a Mishnah, now let's write a Gemara. There's no such thing. Nobody's writing anything, and besides which, it's not organized in that fashion. So there was a discussion that took place in the Beit Midrash about Tefillat HaDerech. Editors later put it in, where they put it in, on Daf Lamed and Masechet Brachot. Why? Why did they put it there?
Relationship to other brachot.
Exactly. It's got a relationship to the discussion about tefillah katsara, which is mentioned in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that if you're going in a place of danger, you say it's tefillah katsara. Alright, and then the Gemara quotes all of the different traditions about tefillah katsara and tefillah haderech and all sorts of related things. So in other words, the organization of the Gemara is based on thematic connections, which may or may not shed light on the previous discussion, but in some way are tangentially related. Examples, a piece that we've studied here before. The famous sugya at the end of the first parak of Batra that talks about who wrote each sefer of Tanakh, the whole famous discussion about the last eight psukim of the Torah and Yeshua. And that all starts from the Mishnah, because you think of Batra is about property. What does that have to do with this? Because at the end of the first parak, the whole first parak is devoted to dividing property. Under what conditions can a partner force another partner to separate? How big does the property have to be to force them to separate? The very last line in the last Mishnah in that parak says that if everything said beforehand is only if they don't agree. But if they do agree, they can separate no matter how small it is. But if they co-own a cloth, then they can't separate even if they agree to separate. Right? And that just becomes the point and say, okay, we're going to put all the discussion about Kedushat Kitvei HaKodesh and about Kitvei HaKodesh, not Kedushat, but about Kitvei HaKodesh here. And that's where all those brightot get thrown in. Right, so that's the connection. Of course, famously, the whole discussion about Nerot Chanukah, which is nowhere in the Mishnah, how did it get put into Shabbat? Because in Shabbat, we're talking about what sort of fuels and wicks you can use for Hadlakat Ner Shabbat. So now, does the same thing apply to Chanukah, and we're off to the races. The same thing is true about Agadah. An Agadah, an Agadic stream or collection, will typically be there because the starting point of it, or some major point of it, has some connection to the Mishnah, some connection to the law. So, for instance, the whole long discussion about Chana's Tfilah at the beginning of the fifth parak of Brachot starts from the law of Brachot that you have to daven, the law of Tfilah that you have to daven with a mode of seriousness. And that opens up the door to say, oh, look at all the halachot we can learn from Chana, and darshan's all the whole story of Chana. And then you get into the Agadah. So now you're wondering about why I have Masechet Shabbat here when we're about to look at Mamad Har Sinai. So the connection seems to be so tenuous, but it's very informative to see how tenuous it could be. The last of the 39 Malachot listed on Shabbat, you're not allowed to do, is carrying. Carrying an item in the public domain, or from the private to the public, from the public to the private. How much caring am I chayav for? Meaning, if I take a speck of dirt and I put it on my hand and I walk outside, am I chayav? The answer is no. Like everything else in halacha, there are minimal shiurim. Right? So the Mishnah from the seventh parak all the way through the ninth lists every conceivable item you could have in their world and what the minimal shear is, including a piece of pottery, and including how much water, including how much ink, and how much of a pelt, you name it, they got a shear for it. The beginning of the ninth parak lists an inference that Rabbi Akiva gets from a pasuk about a minimal shear for something, and then the Mishnah goes on a tangent to show how different chachamim used allusions in psukim to learn halachot, including one, which is, how do we know that shichvat zera, semen, is metame up until 3 days? When a person has shichvat zera come out of them, they're tame, male or female. And so therefore, if someone has it come out of them, even after 3 days, after it was entered, they're metame. How do we know that? Because what do we say at Mamad Har Sinai? What did HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell Moshe? Separate for 3 days. Why is he saying separate for 3 days? So that in case anybody had relations just before that separation time, by the time Mamad Har Sinai comes along and Matan Torah comes, they'll be tahor. They'll go to the mikvah, they'll be tahor. Right? And that leads to a discussion and a dispute about really what's the time period. Is it 72 hours? Is it 2.5 days? Oh, interesting discussions which have halachic implications. That opens the door to have a discussion about the 3 days of separation, Shloshit Yimei Hagbalah, which of course begin tonight. Or 3 days of separation before Mamad Har Sinai. The Shloshit Yimei Hagbalah raises a fascinating dispute that many people are not aware of. And so if I were to ask you, on what date did Mamad Har Sinai happen? What date in the calendar? You'd say Vav Sivan. Except Rabbi Yossi would say Zion Sivan. Because Rabbi Yossi disagrees and he has a whole different cheshbon. And the Gemara says, everybody agrees that the Torah was given on Shabbat. Right? And the only question is, what day of the week was Rosh Chodesh? And they all agree that when Am Yisrael arrived at Midbar Sinai, it was Rosh Chodesh. question was Shachoris Sunday or Monday? If it was Sunday, Rabbi Yossi's opinion, then that means Shabbat is the seventh. And then he has to account for an extra day in between all the commands and the 3 days of Hagbalah and Matan Torah. If, according to Rabbanan, they arrived on Monday. Monday is Rosh Chodesh, Shabbos the 6th. And that's very easy because the 3rd, 4th, and 5th are the 3 days of Hagbalah. And the first day was when Moshe got the commands, and the second day told them to separate 3rd, 4th, and 5th, Yalla. That opens up a door to, I think, all the famous Agadot about Mamad Har Sinai and put them in here. And it may or may not surprise you that many of these have parallel Midrashim in Midrash, you're going to say Shemot, right? Midrash Shir HaShirim Rabbah. And you're going to see this in a minute. Is that, agadically, Chazal looked at Shir HaShirim at the wedding of Shir HaShirim, which does or doesn't happen in the text, as being Mamad Har Sinai. The wedding between the beloved and her lover, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'nei Yisrael, and that wedding's at Har Sinai. And so Midrash Shir HaShirim Rabbah has a lot of parallels to this. And you'll see in here the psukim from Shir HaShirim. All that introduction, sorry, but necessary. So now let's take a look, and we're going to see a couple of midrashim, and just one last word, which I'm terrible saying one last word, but one last word. When somebody comes up to you and says, "What do Chazal say about?" You shouldn't let them continue the question, because it's a fake question. Because Chazal are many voices. And there is next to nothing that when you ask, what do Chazal say about X, the answer could be a definitive single answer.
They say a lot.
Hmm? No, the answer would be there's different approaches. Right? And of course, nobody likes to hear that. But sorry, that's the reality. You want to find out? Sit and learn. And the more you learn, the more you realize the multivocality is actually part of the unity of Torah. But that sounds like a Shagar thing. So we'll leave it alone. Okay. Look on the first page. If you're looking in the English, it's right at the top. If you're looking in the Steinsaltz, it's on the first page at the Bet. If you're looking in the regular Gemara, I feel like, remember in the old days, it should always say, okay, in the Koran, it's page this, and the Arts Scroll, it's page this. Right. If you're looking in the regular Gemara, it is on the first page, about the 15 lines down, there's the two dots. Sorry. And this, by the way, is a very famous Agadah, and the truth is we may just spend time on this Agadah, because this Agadah opens up huge doors of issues of how to study Agadah, which becomes a very thorny topic. Vayityatzevu betachti tahar. That's a phrase from a Pasuk. And what the Pasuk is referring to, Moshe leading Bnei Yisrael out to Har Sinai to meet HaKadosh Baruch Hu. After the 3 days, they come. And it says vayityatzevu, which means they stood like at attention, betachti tahar. Simple pshat, what does betachti tahar mean? At the foot of the mountain. There's a mountain, they stood at the foot of the mountain. However, if you want to play with it, you could say that really the word should be lamargalotahar, which is what I titled the page. Lamargalotahar, right? And rather, betachti tahar could loosely be translated as what? Under the mountain. Under the mountain. Sounds like an Elon Musk thing, right? You guys are Burrow. Okay. So now, Amar Rabbi Avdimi Bar Chama Bar Chasa, Melameit Shekafah HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleihem Et Ahar Ki Gigit. So what does this phrase teach? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaned the mountain over them, or held the mountain over them, like a pot. V'yamar lehem, im atem mekablim haTorah mutav. If you accept the Torah, fine. V'im lav, sham tei kvuratchem. If not, then this is your burial place. Okay, so now, where is Rabbi Avdimi coming from? Where is he getting this from? What's driving this very bizarre statement? What? The word tachtit. And here I'm going to ask a question which we none of us have the answer to, but we can speculate. Is Rabbi Avdimi looking at the Pasuk without any prejudice, without any interest, without any agenda, looking at the Pasuk and saying, oh, a tachtit, that's pretty weird, that must mean they were under the mountain. Why would they be under the mountain? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaned it over them and threatened them. Or is Rav Avdimi coming from a perspective of saying, I would like to portray the event of Mamad Har Sinai as being one of coercion, so here's a pasuk I can link it to. Or some third possibility. I don't know. But tachtit is certainly the hat, the hook that he hangs his hat on. Right? Because the word tachtit. Okay. So now, First question to do with this before going any further is, what do you do when you read this? Now, just a pedagogic note. Got to throw this in. And it's something you can relate to very well because you're a recent, relatively recent high school grad. But in yeshiva high schools, and I think we all know this, in yeshiva high schools, often when there is some sort of an extra class or something like that, like Night Seder, right? So what are we going to teach them? We can't teach like the regular stuff we teach because we got to teach something light. Got to teach something easy or more, something that we can make a siyum on. So they pick, let's pick something easy like
Megillah,
right? Why is Megillah easy?
Sure.
Lots of Agadah. That's the attitude. Lots of Agadah, right? And the thought is, Agadah, that's easy. I got to tell you, Agadah is really hard. Agadah, in a sense, is much harder than Halakha. Because Halakha, if I'm digging a pit on the border between your property and my property, it either is or isn't, we know what it looks like. But here, what do I do with this? This is very, very challenging stuff. Now, you can read it through, in which case you end up with one of two things. I'm just quoting the Rambam. You end up one of two things. Either you end up saying, yes, that's exactly what happened. The mountain was held over them. And they, because thank God they said yes, he didn't drop them and kill them at that spot. Okay. Or you could say, what a silly thing, and walk away. So the Rambam, in his famous comment, more than a comment, his famous presentation of Agadah, in his introduction to the commentary on Perek Chelek, you know, the Rambam wrote an introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah. And the introduction to the commentary on the Mishnah includes three, actually four or five, very big important introductions that are very yisodi. The first one is his general introduction to the Mishnah. Very helpful. The second one is introduction to Pirkei Avot, something known as Shmoneh Prakim, as the Rambam's presentation of religious / social psychology. And the third one is introduction to Perek Chelek. Perek Chelek is the 10th chapter of Masechet Sanhedrin, which includes things that are about belief and about the world to come, which opens the Gemara to amazing Agadot. And in his introduction to Perek Chelek, he has two real seminal pieces. One of them is, this is the appropriate time for me to present the 13 basic beliefs that every Jew must subscribe to. And he lays the whole thing out. He says the first one is a general belief in the existence of God, et cetera, et cetera. And they're long paragraphs, and then somebody in, like, the 15th or 14th century then did a Reader's Digest version on them and said, Anima min b'emunah shlema sheh, right? But that's not what the Rambam wrote. The Rambam wrote much longer than that. Everybody's interested in reading Mark Shapiro's interesting book on the Yud Gimel Ikarim, the limits of Orthodox theology, but that's the Ikarim. Second of all, he also said, it's important to present the proper way to study Agadah. And he said, there are three schools. This, of course, is the Rambam, because in the Rambam, there are always three schools. There's one school on this extreme, one school on that extreme, and then there's the people who are right in the middle. There's one school that takes a look at all of these things and takes them all literally, and these are fools. There's another school that looks at all these things and reads them all metaphorically. These are heretics. And then there's people in the middle who look at them critically and decide which things should be understood literally, which things should be understood metaphorically. In other words, there are agadot which are essential parts of our tradition, and that we take them to be valid. For instance, where is Har HaMoriah? So we hold it to our bayit. That only shows up at Divrei Hayamim. But the agadot have it already starting much earlier. Right? Then there's agadot, which if you look at them, for instance, the Gemara and Brachot, we've talked about it before. Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amot tall. You know that. That's 15 feet tall. Right? He jumped 15 feet in the air, okay, and had a stick that was 15 feet long, and swung it and hit Og Melech Bashan in the ankle. Okay? Now, you take an agadah like that literally, you're in a different universe. Physics don't work. Right? So you have to look at that and say, well, how am I supposed to understand that symbolically? What's the symbolism? What's it trying to communicate? But the reality is, if you don't take that approach, you end up degrading Chazal. You turn Chazal into storytellers, who either you are therefore the eager recipient of all of their stories, which they never intended. They intended something much deeper. But you don't want to look deeper, so you're going to buy into everything on a literal level, which, by the way, means you end up with lots of contradictions. Not only against the text, but against each other, the midrashim that conflict. Or you're going to say, well, they meant that as stories, but I know they're silly, so then you start rejecting Chazal, and that's the heretic. Right? But the chet in Chazal stands for chachamim, which means we're talking about stuff of deep wisdom and knowledge, not fairy tales. So therefore we have to understand that they're telling us, communicating a deep and profound message, and maybe you're doing it through a vehicle of a story which on the surface sounds incredible. Right? And so what do we do with this? What do we do with this? Did God actually hold the mountain over the people and say, if you accept the Torah, fine. If not, then I drop it and you die here? Or does it mean something symbolic? So let's get through this. I'll show you the next piece I want to show you, and then I think we'll actually have an answer to that question almost immediately. So here's the problem. Here I am, a Jew living in the time of David. And I don't want to keep Shabbat. What could I easily turn around and say? I never agreed with the incursion. I never signed on. And that's why the next statement in the follow-up to his Agadah is, Amar Avacha Bar Yaakov, Mikan Moda'a Rabba La'oraita. This is a claim of Moda'a. Moda'a is a halachic writ. And by the way, this is not uncommon for halacha and technical halacha to be woven into an agadic discussion. It's not like we're talking only in metaphor and symbolism. Raktua halacha comes in. It's a moda'ah. Moda'ah is a writ of, it's an affidavit, essentially, of coercion. When somebody is coercing me to negotiate something, I go to the court and I swear out such a complaint. And then, if I go through with the deal because I'm forced to do it, then I can come and now claim my stuff back once I'm safe because I've demonstrated. That's called a moda'ah. Right? So he says, this is a moda'ah. Of the Torah. Anybody can come along and say, I don't want to keep the laws because I was forced into it. I never said yes. So Amar Rava. So Rava then responds, says, and he says, you're right. At a later point in history, we accepted it willingly. When was that? In the times of Achashverosh. Now, what's that pasuk? Kimuvi kiblu ayudim? It's pasuk towards the end of Esther when it says, why did the Jews merit to have such a great holiday? Because they fulfilled it and they accepted to do this holiday for all generations, for all the posterity. Okay, but what's the drasha? Kimu masha kiblu kvar, meaning they now fulfilled what they had already accepted. In other words, in the time of Purim, in the events of Purim, they now reconfirmed the thing that they were originally coerced into doing. Now, by the way, if we take this just on its own terms, that means that any sin committed during the 1,000 years between Matan Torah and Purim is off the hook. Which, by the way, is a little bit of a problem. Because Egel, Meraglim, Korach, Achan, Bat Shela, you just go through the history. All of the Avodah Zarah and Bayit Rishon, all of that. Suddenly, well, you know, it's, I can't really hold you accountable because I held the mountain over you. Clearly, we can't take this as a little statement, which means, what's going on here? Why doesn't Rava turn around and say, not a moda'ah, because we're not going to take it literally. There's something else going on here in this statement. So before analyzing, I just want to show you one other agadah, and we come back to it, one other agadah which will show you the impossibility, at least, with the, when you ask the question, what do Chazal say, as like a single unit, of taking this on a little level. At this point, what is Matan Torah? Matan Torah is do or die. Right? Literally. And what's the do? Accept it. In which case, things are even. If you don't accept it, you die. Okay? Now, take a look. And it's still in that first paragraph in English. I'm way too optimistic when I printed this. In the next two dots, Darash Rabbi Simai, you see it? Mesha'at, it's the going to be the next letter in the Steinsaltz. It'll be the Gimel on the next page. All right, Darash Rabbi Simai. B'sha'ash ikdimu Yisrael na'aseh le'nishma. When Bnei Yisrael said na'aseh before nishma, ba'u shishim yibo shemalachei asherit l'chol achad v'chad mi'Yisrael v'kashu lo shnei k'tarim. Echad k'neged na'aseh v'chad k'neged nishma. 600,000 malachim came down and gave each one of the Jews two k'tarim. In other words, each malach came down with two crowns and found a Jew and they put two crowns on their head, one for Naaseh, one for Nishma. Beautiful. Now, by the way, let's even without even going further, because the next statement is, and then when they sinned, and you see how difficult this is, when they sinned, then 1,200,000 malachim came down and took the crowns away. Now, there's clearly some powerful symbolism there that one malach was able to give you both crowns, but you needed one malach for each crown to take it away. Okay. By the way, who sinned at the ego? Who sinned at the ego? I'm not asking for anybody volunteers here. What? Who sinned at the ego? The answer is, it looks like 3,000 people. Because what happened? Moshe came down and he was angry and everything else. And then he said to B'nai Levi, take your swords and go kill whoever was involved in the ego. And we said 3,000 people were killed.
Right.
So, but here, how does the Agadah have it? Everybody. So you want to say, okay, there's corporate responsibility. You're responsible for everybody. It sounds a little bit strange because everybody's getting nailed here. The people who did it and the people who were there or the people who had power and didn't have power, everybody. All right. But notice, before that, what happens when B'nai Israel say Naaseh and then Nishma? What does the Midrash say? Malachim come down and give them crowns. What does that make Matan Torah now? Matan Torah is not do or die. It's reward or not. In other words, the event is not one where, okay, your life is at stake. If you don't give the right answer, you're dead, which is the first Midrash. But rather, you've come here, and if you say the right thing, you get rewarded beyond what you thought. It's being depicted in two very different ways. So now, if you want to take the position that the Midrashim are presenting historic reality, we've got a little bit of a problem here. If, on the other hand, we want to take the position that the Midrashim are speaking about something on a deeper level and using the garments of a story to communicate that, we don't necessarily have a problem because it could be that there are multiple, and there should be understood, that there are multiple realities going on at Mount Har Sinai. And so let's just explore what that is for a second. We'll go back to the Purim thing and we'll finish. What is the event of Mount Har Sinai? We're standing there, and God says, if you accept the Torah, fine. If not, I bury you here. Why? What does that mean? What does that mean? What has just happened over the course of the last, 400 years? Go back. Abraham. And I selected Abraham. And I put Abraham through the ringer. And I gave Abraham such a challenge. And he stood up to the challenge. And finally had Yitzchak. And boy, did I put him through the ringer after that. And then I put Yitzchak through the ringer. And then finally, Yaakov had a terribly difficult life. And everything else finally came down. And they end up there. And finally, they end up as slaves. And then I intervene. And I send Moshe Rabbeinu. And I do all of this for you. For what purpose? For what purpose?
So you can say no.
What singular purpose? So you'll say yes. Right. So what's the statement of saying, if you say no, Sham Tei Kvuratchem? That everything that you've been, that I've been doing with you, and everything you've been doing for your entire lives, your history, all leads up to this moment. You say no, there's no purpose to it all. Now reverse it. You come to Har Sinai. And what's the natural reaction that anybody would have when told, I got a deal for you? What would most people say? Anybody say when you say, I got a deal for you? What's the deal? Let's see it. Instead, what did the B'nai Israel do?
Right.
Your deal? Good for us. What does that demonstrate about Am Yisrael's relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Total absolute faith. And total absolute passionate abandoned type of love. Whatever it'll take to be with you, God, do it. And that deserves a crown. The two are not at odds because they're speaking to two different issues. One of them is speaking to your existence and who you are and what the purpose of your existence is. That comes to this. Another one is speaks to your passion for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're almost hasty, as we get called hasty people. I'm a paziza. Hasty people who jump in before you know what you're jumping into. Both are accurate. Both are true statements. And they're clothed in different midrashim. And each Baal Midrash is highlighting a different side of it, almost like a prism that you look through and you see the light refracted differently. And so when we look at the Midrashim, if we try to read them as historic reality, we're going to end up not only with an internal contradiction, but with very little that's useful. But if we dig a little deeper, we can see these are different aspects of an event that each Baal Midrash is trying to highlight for us that maybe speaks to who we are, what our purpose is, and what our glory is, and what sort of love we have, and why is it important to study about the history of something that happened in their day 1,500 years earlier. In their day, it's 1,500 years earlier. For us, it's 3,500 years earlier. Why is it important to study that? Because the reality is, who are you? You are your parents. And you are your grandparents and your great-grandparents. That's who you are. You study who you come from, you'll understand who you are. My entire purpose in this world is to say yes to God. Otherwise, there's no point in me being here. That's a powerful statement. And I have a certain glorious relationship with God made of passion that I'm ready to dive in without even finding out if there's water in the pool. Na'aseh v'nishma. Now, by the way, pshat and na'aseh v'nishma doesn't mean that anyways. That's okay. Because that's not the point of the Midrash. Just to go back and end the particular Midrash of the Purim thing. So the Maharal, who was the first person to actually make any sort of methodological presentation or programmatic presentation of how to study Agadah, in his book Tiferet Yisrael, which is a series of essays on Matan Torah, going through all the Agadot, he doesn't buy that the Har Chagigit happened literally. He says, you know what Har Chagigit means? It means that if you are in Mitzrayim and you've seen all of the Makot, and then you've come to Yam Suf, and then you're getting man every day, and then God says, do you want the law? He says, there's emotional blackmail here. You don't have a choice. It's like the mountains being held over your head. And he says, that's why the uptake is, it's a modah, because you could turn around just like when somebody on a Shabbaton tells an amazingly moving story that's got everybody in tears about a kid who can't afford to go to Yeshiva Day School, and right after Avdallah, they hit you up for a contribution. Right? Yeah, okay, but you had me on the ropes. Not a little unfair. He says, so that's why the uptake is Purim. Because Purim, God's not present. You're not seeing miracles in your face. If then you accept God, if then you come back, then that's the real acceptance. Very powerful statement. Doesn't get anybody off the hook for sins they did in the intervening 1,000 years. But that's the way the Maharal understands what's going on in this development in the Midrash. So we're going to do, I think, some more Midrashim over the course of the next few weeks.